This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The South is more than hillbillies and debutantes. That's what Chuck Reese wanted the world to know when he started The Bitter Southerner. It was an online magazine featuring long-form pieces that paint the South as more than just stereotypes. The Bitter Southerner also launched a podcast in December. Each episode explores the South's contributions to American culture through a theme like food or music. Chuck Reese is host of that podcast, also the editor-in-chief of The Bitter Southerner, and he joins us now. Welcome, Chuck.
Hello, Frank. How are you today?
Great. Good to have you on the show. Tell us more about the genesis of The Bitter Southerner.
It's a very long story, but I'll try to make it short. We had this idea, you know, and it was really a chip that I had carried on my shoulder since my very first job in journalism after college, which was in New York with Adweek magazine. And my beat was to cover the media production industries, which at that time pretty much meant just the three big television networks. This was, you know, pre-Hulu, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I would always see the pilots of all the shows, even the ones that didn't make air. And I covered the magazine publishing companies like Time, Inc. And every time I saw a magazine prototype that purported to cover the South or a television show that was set in the South, I really did only see the South through a couple of lenses. And one, as you said earlier, was kind of the debutante party version of the South. And the other one was, you know, something that I've lived with since I was a kid, and it stretches from the Beverly Hillbillies, you know, all the way down to more recently things like Duck Dynasty. And
you don't think the Dukes of Hazzard adequately and clearly represents southern life?
Alas, well, no. Actually, happily, no, it does not.
Yeah,
but no, you know, it's and that had always bugged me. And you know, when it became possible to sort of start a magazine online, you know, you didn't have to raise a lot of capital for paper and ink. Me and three partners took a go at it, and we discovered very quickly that there were a lot of other people who wanted something like this to exist. And, you know, we got through the first year publishing only one long-form, beautifully photographed feature every Tuesday without ever paying a writer or a photographer at all. Hmm. The writers and photographers came to us just to sort of, I guess, help jumpstart the thing into existence. And then we kind of got in the t-shirt business after a year. And, you know, we've kind of built up a business model for this thing over the last 5.5 years. And it's, you know, it grows slowly and organically, but it grows.
Well, it grew into a podcast. I want to talk about how this translated into a podcast, because in one of your episodes, you go back to the beginning of actually The Bitter Southerner, and you talk about cocktails. So tell us about the conversation and the events that led to that, because I know it starts out in New Orleans, right? You're in Louisiana. And it's one, again, one of these cases of mis or underrepresentation. Tell us that story.
Yeah, sure. In September 2011, my then fiance, now wife, Stacy, and I spent Halloween week in New Orleans. And, you know, we had gotten a little bit fascinated with this resurgence in, you know, I guess the easiest way to say it would be sort of classic bartending. You know, bartenders who knew what they were doing, who knew the stories that were inside the bottles and the recipes, and knew how to make good drinks. And we spent, you know, time in three or four different bars in New Orleans that just were doing amazing things. And the next week I got home and something popped up in my Facebook feed, some list of the 50 best cocktail bars in the world. And I opened it only because I thought that one of those places in New Orleans would be on the list, you know, and I was curious. And when I opened it, not only were none of those bars in New Orleans on the list, there was not a single bar in the American South on the list. And so the idea was simply to just do a little cocktail blog about bartenders in the South. And my partner and the designer of the Bitter Southerner, Dave Whitling, and I, he agreed to design the thing, and we sat down and talked about, well, what do we want to name this cocktail blog? And we went through the ingredients that went into cocktails, like citrus juices and syrups and liqueurs and whiskey. And, you know, we didn't want it to be the tangy Southerner or the sweet Southerner. But when we got to the bitters that go in cocktails, we were like the Bitter Southerner. And we were like, whoa, that name is kind of a quadruple entendre. And we wound up spending another year sort of figuring out what that name was telling us to do.
And what one of the things it was telling you to do was tell a deeper story. So it wasn't just, you know, including now the left out, overlooked great cocktail bars of New Orleans, but really getting into some of the deep history and some of the fascinating stories that would surround a topic like alcohol, right?
Correct. And I think, you know, we brought that to life a little bit on that specific, you know, we started the podcast with three episodes in succession, each looking at the South's contributions to American culture through sort of what were the original three legs of our stool: music, food, and cocktails, and or just drinking. And, you know, I've learned, I thought I knew a lot about the South when I started this thing five and a half years ago, but man, I have learned so much. And one of the things I learned was this really deep history of how so many of the great classic Southern cocktails, like the Sazerac and the Mint Julep, those recipes came about from bartenders who were enslaved back in those days. And, you know, as my friend John T. Edge of the Southern Foodways Alliance always says, you know, we owe a debt of gratitude to those people. Mm. You know, I mean, the simplest way I like to put it is, you know, it's kind of a Southern thing, you know, for people to stand around the table, particularly on a holiday, and say, you know, dear Lord, bless this food and the hands that prepared it. There's a whole lot of stories and all the hands that prepared it. And that's what we try to do, is just to show people what's behind all these things that they enjoy and that are already part of their lives.
Well, and one of the voices we hear on the podcast is Kathleen Purvis, who's the food editor of the Charlotte Observer. And she wrote a book that plots out six of what she called liquor trails through the South. And she documents how the region's craft distillers are creating new Southern traditions. But she also talked about the fact that there are actually more female craft distillers now.
There are a lot of women making, who are master distillers, who are the ones in their family who are actually doing the distilling. And they say that women have an advantage because our taste buds are different than men's. And so we can, physiologically, we can pick up more tastes sometimes than men do. But I heard from an awful lot of those distillers who told me, you know, a dealer will come in looking to sell them supplies, and it'll be, oh, well, I need to speak to the distiller. Can you call your husband for me? And they just kind of go, oh, God, again, really? My husband and I were out touring one time, and we noticed that if I asked a male distiller a question, they would turn and answer my husband. You know, we run into that all the time. People don't expect women to be involved in the alcohol industry, but we are.
Kathleen Purvis on the Bitter Southerner podcast. My guest is the podcast host, Chuck Reese, who's also the editor-in-chief of the Bitter Southerner. So this gets to some of the surprise. Once you take on a topic like that, it's not just going to be nine recipes for a great mint julep. You know, you're sort of tackling questions like this. And immigration. You tackle that in an episode centered on Clarkston, Georgia, where you live, Chuck. Tell us about Clarkston.
Well, Clarkston is statistically the most ethnically diverse square mile in America. Clarkston has been a national refugee resettlement area for more than 30 years now. And over those 30 years, more than 60,000 refugees have made Clarkston their first home. And I moved out of this, Stacy and I moved out of the city about a year ago and moved to Clarkston, and you start looking around you, and, you know, my whole adult life, I grew up in the mountains in North Georgia, but my whole adult life has been spent either in Atlanta or in New York City. and, you know, both places where there are large immigrant populations. And Clarksville was the only place I'd ever lived where I would see people walking down the street and I couldn't even guess what continent they were from. And I went on to learn that in the 13,000 of us who live in Clarkston, Georgia, 75 different ethnic groups from around the world are represented. And it's just amazing to see those people work together. And, you know, you see firsthand how much they cherish what we refer to as the American dream and how they build that for their families over time. Because obviously, you know, now we've got second and before long we'll have third generation, you know, immigrants to America who came to our little town first.
And you talked
there's a lot of Southern hospitality and all of that, you know?
Yeah, and it just changes some of the impression that you have of the South as this closed off place where you're going to find nothing but people who are very much alike. The podcast talked to Ted Terry, who's the mayor of Clarkston, who I guess wears the town's nickname, right? The Ellis Island of the South as a badge of honor. Here he is talking about it.
We have a mosque across the streets of Buddhist temple, down the streets of Baptist church. Around the corner is an Ethiopian Orthodox church, a Hindu Buddhist temple, all within 1 square mile. And yet no instances of domestic terror, no religious wars, no ethnic conflicts.
Mayor Ted Terry of Clarkston, Georgia, from the Bitter Southerner podcast. I'm talking to Chuck Reese, who's the host of that podcast and editor-in-chief of the Bitter Southerner. You know, and that gets to podcast and blogs and some of the new media and new platforms or recent platforms apart from legacy media that are getting at the stories right under our nose, right? And revealing, again, just overturning stereotypes. I mean, I wonder for you, who started out with the goal of overturning the stereotype, how many times your eyes have been opened just in the couple of years you've been doing this?
Well, I'm guessing at least 2,000 times, at least.
Yeah.
No, seriously, yeah. At least yeah. Once a day I yeah. learned something about the South that I did not know. We evidently are really good at hiding stories under the rocks sometimes. And it's real fun to go out in the field and turn them over.
Yeah, they get hidden and they get misshapen a little bit, too, because sometimes you're trying to tell a particular story and write people in and write people out. One of the things, of course, you cannot talk about the South without talking about food. That's a stereotype we're going to keep. But again, the story of food becomes complicated in a hurry, and the way we talk about it and what we conceal and what we reveal is important. The food episode, we hear from Michael Twitty, who's a culinary historian, who researched the question of who owns Southern food to give, and it gives this region its complicated history. So here's what Michael Twitty had to say on the podcast.
So ownership is, you know, in a capitalist society, ownership and fences are very important. We're learning that the hard way, aren't we? So I would say that my answer is very nice and philosophical. You know, who owns Southern food? Whoever is going to take responsibility for owning its past, maintaining its present, and securing its future in a positive and forward-leaning way.
Culinary historian Michael Twitty on the Bitter Southerner podcast. I'm talking to the podcast host Chuck Reese, also editor-in-chief of the Bitter Southerner. Tell us more about that episode and what we mean by ownership and the sort of complicated history of where this came from.
Well, I think the point of that entire episode and what Michael's trying to get at in his explorations is the fact that, you know, I think so many people believe they've got a handle on what Southern culture is. In other words, they believe they can define it specifically, what its music sounds like, what its foods taste like. But most people don't realize that since colonial times, the culture of the South has been an evolutionary process. It never stopped. Whether people were brought here in chains, enslaved, or people came here to try to build a little better lives for themselves and their families, all of those people put a little bit into the gumbo pot that is Southern culture, you know. And I've always found it very significant. Like one of the things that I learned really early on in the journey of doing this was a little something about okra, the vegetable that all of us know who enjoy gumbo is the thing that sort of provides that mucilaginous goo that brings all the flavors together. Well, so you've got this dish that's so highly representative of all the influences that have come into the South and all the flavors that have come into the South. And it's held together by this undeserved guilt, okra, because okra is not native to North America. It was brought here by slavers because they believed it would be a cheap crop to farm to feed slaves. And when you put all of that together, you understand how complicated the culture of the South actually is. And I sort of feel like it's the bitter Southerner's job to complicate people's understanding of the South.
Not only what the Southern culture is, but also its many contributions to the broader American culture and the way it has fanned out and insinuated itself into that culture. And people like North Carolina folklorist Bill Ferris are largely responsible for that. These are the people who have been documenting this history for a long time and its contributions. Bill Ferris, for 50 years or so, he retired last summer as associate director of the Center for the Study of the American South right here at UNC Chapel Hill. And you talked with him about why he became a folklorist and what was so important to him about preserving this culture, right?
That's right. And first I want to say, since you're on WUNC, that Bill Ferris is my favorite North Carolinian in the world. He's something else, but Bill grew up in an unusual situation. He was raised on a farm in the Mississippi Delta, not maybe 16 miles away from Natchez. And his family bought a farm in the early 20th century, where on the farm were still black families, descendants of people who had been slaves on that farm, and they were sharecroppers there. And Bill's parents were all very highly educated people. Bill refers to his experience as almost like growing up in a salon, you know, an intellectual salon. And from his youth was hearing the stories and gospel songs, the hymns and the blues that came from those families who lived on the farm. And, you know, he and his siblings were taught that these people were equals to them. And Bill set out recording hymns in church and taking photographs when he was 12 years old. And, you know, he was, I think, uniquely by circumstances, positioned to see the contributions of everyone he grew up around in a light that wasn't filtered through Jim Crow.
Well, I want to play just a little sample of that he recorded and appeared on the Atlanta-based Dusta Digital release of this material. Inmates at a Mississippi, at Parchman Farm in Mississippi, singing the song "Waterboy Drowned in the Mobile Bay."
Did you hear about the water boy drowned? Did you hear about the water boy drowned? The Mobile Bay, Lord,
the Mobile Bay,
and there's he dropped in.
It's just a little bit of "Waterboy Drowned in the Mobile Bay," recorded by North Carolina folklorist Bill Ferris, featured on the Bitter Southerner podcast. I'm talking to host Chuck Reese. So, Chuck, just a few seconds left, but what's coming up on the podcast?
Well, the next episode of the podcast looks at a particular aspect of Southern culture, which is, goes along with the hospitality, which is the way we come together to take care of people around us, the way we help people who've been through tough times heal. And we will be looking at that through the perspective of social justice. We'll be looking at it through music. And, we're going to look at how the South helps make people live a little better.
Chuck Reese, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure, Frank. Thank you for having me.
Chuck Reese is the host of the Bitter Southerner podcast and editor-in-chief of Bitter Southerner. Just ahead, Mandolin Orange's new album out next week. We get a preview right here on the State of Things. Stay with us.